Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Today we'll be talking about adding perennial edibles to your garden. And two guests for you. One, Kevin Schesso, Ag Development Educator for UW-Madison Division of Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn Counties. Kevin, good to have you with us.
Good morning, Larry.
And Diana Alfeth, the UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County. Diana, welcome.
Hey, Larry. Nice to be here.
Well, I tell you what, it's great to have both of you with us today. And so as you listen to these two experts, think about it a little bit. How are your rhubarb and asparagus doing this year? Do you have questions about planting fruit or nut trees? Give a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Kevin, we'll start with you for a second here. We've talked about adding edibles to the landscape on other shows, but we've never focused on plants that give food year after year. What are some of your favorites?
Well, I think you, in your introduction, you mentioned some of the more common ones that I like to grow, and I think most people, you know, have grown rhubarb and asparagus. Those are common vegetables, but of course, we know there's other edible perennials that we don't have to grow and start from seed every year like we do with a lot of our annual vegetables. But I don't know of a person who hasn't tried growing apples or strawberries or raspberries. Those are very common edibles that are perennials. And perennials, they come back every year. You know, we don't have to mess with them. And planting them every spring like we do our annual crops. But those are some of the common ones that I like to grow, and there's all kinds of other additional perennial plants that have potential to provide us with an edible fruit or nut, and I know some of those are ornamental and have landscape value, and maybe that's something that Diana could talk about.
Yeah, Diana, you want to go with that thought?
Sure. You know, that's the thing is a lot of times people think, oh, I just don't have the space for an orchard or a big raspberry patch, or so I can't really grow anything edible in my landscape. But that's really not true, because there are a lot of these shrubs especially, but also trees that are very ornamental in addition to providing fruit that's edible, not just to wildlife, but to us. And so some of those would be things like service berries. There's a Regent service berry that only grows 6 to 8 feet tall, and it's beautiful white spring flowers, and then berries that you can, if you get there before the cedar waxwings do, you can make jams and jellies and things. Aronia is another one that's been grown as a landscape plant for a long time. And even things like blueberries are beautiful little landscape plants. They can be tucked in your front yard with all your other shrubs. And then, you know, as Kevin mentioned, things like rhubarb. Rhubarb can be actually quite ornamental with the big leaves and be a little fashion statement in your landscape, in addition to providing some food to eat, especially in spring.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we already have a number of callers online with questions for you two, so why don't we go to the phones and take some calls. Christy in Chippewa Falls, we'll give you a chance first. Hi, Christy.
Good morning. Thank you. I'm curious about growing hazelnuts in my home landscape. Thank you.
Growing hazelnuts. Well, Kevin, what about it?
Yeah, well, this is an up-and-coming landscape and potentially commercial nut crop that actually the University of Wisconsin-Madison and a whole bunch of other people in the upper Midwest have been working on. And it's called the Upper Midwest Hazelnut Initiative. And these folks have been trying to screen wild cultivars of hazelnuts, as well as there's some hybrid hazelnut varieties that are already commercially available. So, yes, hazelnut is a wonderful plant to try and to grow for its edible nuts. Just like with all of our perennial plants, we've always got to think about the wildlife and how do we share our bounty with them or protect our plants. But the hazelnut, what we are excited about is it's a native plant to Wisconsin. You know, it obviously does produce that nut. And with the selections they're making right now, they're trying to find those plants that have the larger nut size or have a better growth habit. Again, if we're thinking about this from a commercial standpoint, but even a wild hazelnut that you might have growing out in your property, or if you want to move one from the wild, you know, it's another plant that, you know, I think we can take a look at and, you know, eat the nuts just like you would, you know, any other nut crop. You just got to figure out how to husk them and get the meat out. And that's always a challenge with a nut crop. So if you go online to that Upper Midwest Hazelnut Development website or just do a search on that, you'll find all kinds of information on growing hazelnut. And there's actually some limited supply, I believe, of hazelnuts that are still available that they were offering through that website. And I think it's from the Forest Ag Enterprises. It's like a nursery that is in partnership with this group. So, yeah, check out that website. And I don't think they're really difficult to grow. They grow quite readily in the wild. You just got to figure out how to beat the squirrels to them.
There you go. Oh, man. Thank you, Christy. Janice in Appleton, your turn now. Hi, Janice.
Hi. See, I'm looking for a pear tree, the D'Angelo pear tree, and I am striking out around in this whole area, but I am looking for something that is like it because I'm not liking the graininess of a regular pear. So that's why I would like this one in particular because it's more buttery.
All right.
Help me.
Well, it's probably another Kevin in question.
Well, yeah, I guess whenever we're looking at selecting varieties, you know, we have to take in mind, you know, which fruit varieties are suited for Wisconsin, and apples are certainly one of those. And that specific variety that you mentioned, you know, I can't say I'm, you know, that up on specific pear varieties, but, you know, pears can grow in Wisconsin. I don't think they're quite as easy to grow, in my opinion. Now, I'm up in the northern part of the state where maybe our climate interferes with our ability to grow some of these fruits a little easier than other places. But, you know, I guess, you know, you just have to keep looking online and seeking out nurseries that are selling plants that are adapted to our Midwest climate. Whenever we buy things, we need to keep that in mind. There's a thing called Providence, and that's basically where the plant was grown and kind of evolved. And if we start bringing plants that are too far away from our kind of normal environmental conditions, they might not do as well. So I don't know, Diana, if you have any references that you know of that, you know, we have our standard affair that I think most people are aware of in Wisconsin as far as our nurseries in the Midwest. But do you have any suggestions on where she might look?
Yeah, so the D'Angelo pear is known to be kind of a little more buttery flavor, like mentioned and stuff. And it is hardy to zone 5, which means we don't usually want to grow it up here in the northern half of the state. But if you're in Appleton, you might be close enough there. One of the problems with these fruit trees is, you know, they might make it through winter, but they get stressed by the winter so much, and then they have disease issues that get in. That's one of the biggest problems with growing peaches in Wisconsin. The other thing is, if you've been watching the weather right now, you know that we are under a freeze warning for last night and tonight, and especially in the eastern part of the state. So if we get these cold spells, especially this time of year, once those trees have started to break dormancy and maybe getting ready to flower, you get a lot of damage and then you don't get any fruit that year. So I don't know if the pear trees down in the Appleton area are trying to bud out yet, but a lot of times these ones that are marginally hardy because they bud out early in the season and then they get nailed by these late spring freezes and frost situations. So I don't know of another pear that's similar to D'Angelo that would be a good choice, But yeah, because they're not necessarily hardy in the northern part of the state, we may not really have a good Wisconsin nursery that's producing them.
There you go, Janice. Thank you so much for calling. Well, Bailey in Beaver Dam has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Bailey.
Hi there. How's it going, guys, today? So I've been helping my grandma in the garden ever since I was a little kid. And within the last couple of years, I guess we've been getting has been going down. And I'm not sure if it's too early in the year to tell, but this year it just seems like there's not any shoots coming up at all. I didn't know
so
if
asparagus.
Any tips on, you know, any tips on how to get that going again, or it is in with a bunch of rhubarb, so I don't know if that affects it at all.
Okay, so we've got, and this is an old bed, right, Bailey?
Right. She's probably had it in there for 15, 20 years.
Yeah. Maybe it needs a, maybe you need a new bed. I don't know. What do you think, Diana?
Well, yeah. So you said that it's, there's rhubarb and asparagus growing in the same area?
Yeah,
there's a bunch of rhubarb against the long back wall, and then the asparagus kind of grows out in front of it usually.
Okay, so you might just be having a competition thing going, and the rhubarb is winning. And, you know, asparagus can get a little tricky, especially if it gets overtaken by, usually the biggest problem is quackgrass or other kinds of weeds. But rhubarb is a monstrous plant with a big root system, and so there might just be a competition thing going there that's causing that asparagus to go downhill over time. Do you know if she ever fertilizes or puts compost or anything around it?
She does not.
Yeah, so you might try that to give. Maybe it needs a nutrient boost. You might even try doing a soil test to see for sure where your soil is at. If there's like a low phosphorus or potassium level in there, that could be, again, not just killing it, but stressing it a little bit so that it comes back less and less and less every year. But I think Larry might be onto something here where it might be time to kind of rejuvenate things, kind of dig it up and separate the rhubarb and the asparagus and kind of start. You can move those asparagus plants. They take a while to get established. In our area, asparagus is not showing any growth yet. So it may be on the early side yet. That all relates to soil temperature and that kind of thing. So I'd give it time before I'd say that the asparagus isn't coming up yet. But it sounds like you might just have a major competition problem.
Yeah. Well, and rhubarb is pretty easy to move, too. You can move the rhubarb away and clean out the area and put in some good male asparagus plants and have a really good success.
All right. And just a comment on, you know, just about any perennial planting is they are not maintenance free. I mean, oftentimes we think, oh, I'm going to put in this perennial plant, you know, shrub or perennial flowers, and you get it established and mulch it, and you think, oh, I'm done. But you might be done for a year or two if you're lucky, but there's always maintenance that has to be done on our perennial plants. And, you know, sometimes with some of these plants that like to expand, like rhubarb and the asparagus and any number of other perennial plants that spread by rhizomes and whatnot in their crown, we need to think about dividing those and rejuvenating them. And, you know, sometimes you can multiply and get more of that plant. But that's just something to keep in mind with our perennials. And this is a little late to be doing some of that dividing, but I think it's still early enough in the growing season that you wouldn't, you know, shock those plants if you were to go in there and start to dig and divide those crowns and get in there and just, like Diana said, clean up some of that competition and just do some renovation. So it's just something to keep in mind.
Yep, keep that in mind, Bailey. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, we're taking a look at perennial edibles, among other things, here on the program today with our guests, Diana Alfeth and Kevin Chesso. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer, Tyler Ditter, our engineer, and you are listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us for this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller with my guest, Diana Alfeth, UW Extension horticulture educator for Pierce County. Kevin Chesso is the Ag Development Educator with UW-Madison and Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn County. So great to have them with us. Questions, give a call, 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Janet in Marquette County has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Janet.
Hi. I have a question regarding the fungal diseases of tomato plants in the garden. I understand that most of it is soil-borne, and is it caused by the manure that you put on the garden? And how do you cleanse the soil? And also, are those tomatoes treatable? Can you eat those tomatoes? Are they preserved? I find that there are five different types of diseases, and our garden has each and every one of them.
Oh, well, man. Diana, go ahead.
Yeah, so tomatoes are the most commonly grown garden vegetable, and they're also, in my opinion, the hardest because of these diseases. But we could talk for days on it. But basically, you're right, there are several diseases. We lump them. There's septoria leaf spot and early blight, and then there's late blight that comes in later in the summer and can wipe out a patch and stuff. Late blight is airborne. It blows in. I always blame Minnesota for it. But it blows in later in the year. But septoria and the early blight organisms, they are soil borne. They don't necessarily come in on manure. They are just kind of in soil. Once you get it, sometimes you might bring it into your garden originally on a transplant or something, and it's like everywhere. So you can't really cleanse the soil. We don't have anything that you can fumigate the soil with and kill all that stuff. And killing all the good stuff as well. So what you need to do is to try to keep soil from splashing up onto your tomato plants. These fungal diseases waste wet conditions, and they need to get on the leaves, and when the leaves are damp, and then they can take hold and you get spots and blotches and death and all that sort of thing. So the best thing to do is when you choose your tomato plants, choose ones that have disease resistance. And when you read the tag, there will be letters after the name of the tomato in many cases, so like F and S and V, and just get the ones with the most letters after them because those have the most disease resistance, okay? And then when you plant your tomatoes, immediately, and I don't mean like a week later, I mean immediately, mulch around them. And the best mulch that you can do is a layer of newspaper, which would be about 6 or 7 sheets thick, or a layer of common brown corrugated cardboard. Put that all around and then put some kind of organic mulch on it, like straw or leaves or dry grass clippings or something like that, and that holds the paper or cardboard down. What that does is when it rains, when the raindrop hits the soil, it can't splash up onto the plant, because that's how these diseases usually get started. They splash up, little soil splashes up onto the lower leaves, and then it takes hold, and then it works its way up the plant as the summer goes on. So the soil can't be cleansed, but you want to do as much as you can to avoid that soil from getting up onto the leaves. And then in addition to that, make sure that you're spacing your tomatoes well apart so that when they're fully mature, they're not touching each other, because you want to encourage good air circulation to keep the leaves dry, because dry leaves are not hospitable for these fungal diseases. You might prune up the lowest branches, again, to get more air circulation around there, prune out suckers on the plants to keep the canopy a little more open. As a last resort, if you're growing a variety that you just love and it's not disease resistant, well, then that's where you need to look at fungicides if you have a problem year after year. But those fungicides usually have to be applied before the disease symptoms start showing up. So most fungicides are protectants. They have to be on those leaves before the fungal organism germinates. They don't cure it once it's there. So that's, in a nutshell, the best way to reduce your tomato diseases. I think everybody always has a little bit of disease on their tomatoes. If you do good fall cleanup, then make sure you don't have that plant debris laying around, because those leaves that are affected, that fall into the soil, that's what
keeps it in the soil to splash up the next year. But good fall hygiene, prevention as much as possible, that's your best bet. Kevin, you have anything else to add?
Well, I cut out there. I lost my connection, but I don't know if you mentioned, sometimes if you really want to, you know, start fresh, you can always take a break from that spot in the garden, or maybe doing tomatoes in your garden at all, and then move them maybe into containers. It's not the same as in-ground, but there's a lot of varieties that do well in containers. So that's sometimes a way to kind of avoid the pathogen by moving them, you know, out of the area, using a potting soil. You know, if you're buying sterilized potting soil, it should be disease free. So it's just another way to kind of take a break if you're really having difficulty with the tomato diseases in the ground in your garden spot.
That's a good point. And usually that's why we always, you know, promote crop rotation, and you have to rotate by family. So potatoes and eggplants are in the same family, and so are peppers. So you don't want those in the same place, because that can feed the fungal diseases, keep them going. But we would like at least 2 years in between tomato crops in the same place, and three is better. So if you can put those in those containers, that's a great option.
You know, and I got into straw bale gardening, and I tell you, the disease is very, very much reduced if you've got your tomatoes going in straw bales.
That's a great point, Larry, because there is no soil. There's no source for that those little diseases to get on there. So, you know, if that works, that's a great option.
There you go. There's all you need to know, Janet. Thank you so much. Let's go to Kent in Reedstown next. Hi, Kent.
Hi there. I've got the raspberries that I put in a couple of years ago. I'm not sure the type. And I think they've just been, something has been eating them. And so now I put up a rabbit fence, assuming it's rabbits. And but I've noticed the raspberry that I think there are raspberries down in my woods, they don't seem to eat those. And I'm just wondering what's eating my raspberries, and will they come back?
Do you know where the damage is occurring? Is it on the top part of it or down at the base? Or?
Well, you know, some of them are about, you know, six to 8 inches from the ground, and then mostly it's down lower, I'd say.
And that would it be during the growing season that you're seeing this damage?
No, it's during the winter.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, rabbits are wonderful herbivores that will eat all kinds of soft, woody, perennial vegetation. And I just know from personal experience, and I've seen this year after year, where there's a snow line, the raspberry canes will be chewed right to that spot, you know. And then, of course, when the snow melts, you're left with this stub of about 6 to 12 inches, depending on the snow depth. So rabbits are voracious eaters of raspberries in the winter months. So perhaps that's what's going on, because if the whole cane is gone, something major has done that. I mean, we do have insects that work on the top, cane borers in the bottom, but you know, when it's nibbled down and there's just a stub, I really wonder if that's not bunny rabbits.
Yeah.
When it's cut off, does it look like it's at a sharp angle, like somebody brought a pruners along and just nipped it off?
Yeah, it's kind of a sharper.
Yeah, that's rabbits. That's how they chew things off. It's a very clean cut, and it's at an angle, and that's just how they chew down everything over winter. If it were deer, I always forget, deer only have teeth on, what, the top or the bottom or something?
Up
I forget
bottom.
Which one. And they tend to rip stuff off. So when they chew on something or eat something, it's a ragged edge. But if it's a clean cut at an angle, looks like somebody whacked it with a pruner, it's rabbits. And the reason that they're in your patch versus the woods is habitat. It must be closer for them. It must be easier access for them. There's more of it there. But typically they will come back because they have a strong root system, so they should be sprouting up new canes. Now, the question is, raspberries bloom and produce fruit on the flora canes, which is the second year cane. So with raspberries, the canes, the first year it just grows leaves, the second year it flowers and fruit, and then that cane dies. So depending on what kind of raspberries you have, you might be getting reduced production if those flora canes are disappearing, if they were summer bearing, or your production's going to be really delayed. It's going to take a while for those canes to grow back up and flower and produce fruit, so you're going to be getting more of a fall crop. So if this is a recurring problem, it's probably a good idea to put up some bunny fencing to keep them away there over the winter. But then again, you don't have to go out in there and prune your raspberries, which is a painful job sometimes.
Yes, it is. There you go, Kent. Thank you so much for calling. Susie from the town of Genesee emailed to say she planted some native prairie plants a couple of weeks ago. There are zone 3 perennials, butterfly weed, milkweed, and so forth. Should she cover these tiny plants tonight to protect from the frost? And that's probably a good question. A lot of people are probably have that question relating to any flowers they might have out now and so forth. Because it's going to get cold tonight.
If you've been paying attention to the forecast, we are really concerned about this freeze. But you should all remember that this is not unusual. This is not outside of our normal last frost, last freeze realm throughout most of the state. So I think the eastern part of the state is going to be worse than the western part. But some of the areas like Black River Falls and that area that always gets really cold, they're going to get down possibly into the teens tonight. So what we could expect for freeze damage is hard to say because it's not only dependent on how low the temperature gets, but how long it stays at that temperature. As far as perennials and native perennials that have already sprouted and put on some growth, they're not likely going to be killed. They might have some foliage damage so that when they start growing again, there'll be brown tips on the leaves, that sort of thing. If it's anything that's sending up a flower bud already, that flower bud might be deformed or not come through. Covering it isn't going to hurt anything. Okay, if you've got the ability to cover some of these things, that might keep it a little bit better. But what's worrisome is this is not a frost warning. This is a freeze warning, and there's a difference, and it means that that temperature is going to get quite a bit lower. So we have obviously concerns about fruit trees and fruit buds in the northern part of the state. You know, the apples aren't really budding out or anything, but in the southern part, they are. And depending on how far along they are in that development process, when they're hit by this cold, that's going to determine how bad the damage is. So there's a lot of unknowns, but bottom line is if you have anything that you can bring into your garage overnight, if it's in a container or a hanging basket or something, do that. If it's something that's planted in the ground already, if you have the ability to cover, it's certainly not going to hurt anything, and it probably will help you with a couple of degrees anyway. And then we keep our fingers crossed.
That's about all we can do. That's about all we can do.
Yeah, if I might just jump in and just let people know that, you know, the University of Wisconsin-Madison Division of Extension has a number of different websites and resources, of course, that people should be aware of. And one of them is our Wisconsin Fruit website, and that is just fruit.wisc.edu. On that website, there's just a ton of information related to fruit crops. It's kind of written for the commercial grower, but there's a lot of good information that homeowners can gather from this site. But there was a recent article put up there under the news tab that talked specifically about this subject on fruit trees. And there's some charts and some data that talk about what those critical temperatures are. And basically, if you've got any kind of pink showing from your flower blossoms and a flower exposed, that's when they're most susceptible. And our temperature tolerance is for most of our fruit is right around 28 degrees once you see that pink bud exposed. If you don't have the bud the flower bud or blossom exposed, then they can take much colder temperatures. So, again, it depends on how far along those plants are. And then if you have the ability to manage some of that temperature around the plant, you know, that's where you can do some of that frost protection. But that website has a lot of good information on it, so I encourage people to take a look at that. Again, it's fruit.wisc.edu, and I believe I shared that website with Jill, Larry.
Yeah, we do, and we have that up on our page. So go to wpr.org/Larry over in the program notes. We've got that reference, and there's another one, the UW Extension Horticulture website, another good reference there. So hort.extension.wisc.edu. But we'll have that up on our page, the Larry Mueller Show page. So if you didn't get it written down, just go there and go to our program notes over on the right side, and you will see them. You will see them all. Well, Charlotte in River Falls has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Charlotte.
Yeah, we have a prairie, and we have issues with wild raspberries coming up. And my husband was wondering what the best way to kill them is. He thought maybe the buckthorn method, or trying to dig off, you know, dig through the roots. What would be the best way to kill wild raspberries?
Well, what do you think, Kevin?
Well, now we're talking a perennial in a perennial, right? We got all this.
Yeah.
And the difference there is, you know, one's woody and one's maybe not woody. You know, any time we're trying to remove plants, you know, in an environment like that, it can really be challenging because there's very little options from a herbicide or a chemical standpoint that aren't going to damage some of those other desirable plants. So depending on how big the patch is and how many of those raspberries are kind of encroaching on that area, you know, you could try physically going in there and removing them. You know, it might take many attempts and multiple years to thin out that patch because they've got that perennial root system, and they have those underground, you know, roots and rhizomes that's how they spread. So using hand tools or grubbing them out by hand might be way too much effort. And then you're really looking at how might you spot treat that with some kind of herbicide. And that's where you got to really be careful, because if you're spraying the base of those plants, you're likely going to be, you know, impacting some of the surrounding plants that, you know, maybe you don't want the spray to get onto. So, you know, there's any number of products you might try, you know, to do that. And being it's a natural area, maybe you don't want to spray some of these more synthetic type herbicides. But black plastic, you know, you can try to smother them. You know, again, it just depends on how many are in an area and what effort you want to go to.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, and I have a prairie too, and we're getting that same kind of thing. But it seems, in our case anyway, it's kind of one here, one there. But you do want to get them before they continue to spread. Like Kevin said, they have these rhizome roots that spread, and then you'll get a big patch, and it's a lot harder to deal with. So your question about the buckthorn method, I think, is a good option, especially right now because these prairie plants haven't greened up yet and haven't started going. So like when Kevin talked about the herbicide, if the herbicide is a contact herbicide like Roundup or Triclopyr, Triclopyr doesn't kill grasses, but if anything is still dry, that herbicide's not going to get into it. So if you can go in there and whack those canes off and just squirt that cut stem, hopefully that herbicide will go down into the root system and kill it, or at least knock it back. But like Kevin said, these things are tenacious, and it's probably not going to be a one-and-done thing. You're going to have to keep up with it for several years. And then, you know, this is kind of nature. Nature likes to put those brambles in the prairies.
Yeah.
And the birds bring them in. So it's going to be a continuing thing. So if you have them, like I said, try to get them while you can before they get into too big of a patch.
Otherwise, I don't know about mowing. Mowing will whack them off, but they'll back up from the root system, so it would have to be a regular mowing to starve out those root systems. And, you know, that may or may not be an option depending on your slope and equipment and all that sort of thing. So,
yeah. There you go, Charlotte. A little bit of work ahead of you over probably a few years' time. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Russ in Kettle Moraine, it's your turn. Hi, Russ.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call, and thanks for a great program.
Thanks.
My question's an easy one. Can you tell me just exactly how to grow morel mushrooms? And if you can't, could you tell me, give me the coordinates of where I could go and find some?
You know, I was looking on my Facebook page yesterday, and a friend had posted a picture of about a half a bushel basket of morel mushrooms, and I was very envious.
And that's from this year?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Well, they must
be down south, huh?
Yeah, they must be down south, because typically they are out when the lilacs are in bloom, and the lilacs around here in west central Wisconsin aren't anywhere near thinking about blooming yet.
Oh, but they are in southern Wisconsin.
Okay, okay.
So, but I'm not a mycologist or anywhere close to a mushroom expert, but I have hunted morels, I can't say extensively, and from what I know, you know, they are very sought after and a delicacy, and if you know where a patch is, you know, you pretty much protect that and don't let the neighborhood know about it. But
no.
They're also, from what I've, you know, read and heard about, is they are very difficult to propagate, you know, so we've got these, you know, mushroom logs we can grow. Shiitakes and any other number of propagated, cultivated, you know, mushrooms. But the morels seem to be a little bit more challenging to grow, you know, domestically, if you will. So then you're forced to just be hunting for them out in the wild. And
yeah.
and tricks to that, too.
I've noticed in the last 5 years or so that there are more, like, morel kits and things like that. I don't have any experience with it. I don't know how successful they are, but they're worth a try. Otherwise, they tend to, what I've always heard is they are around dead elm trees, and I find that to be true because we have a lot of elms that have died over the years from Dutch elm disease, and that's where we find the morels. But it's usually the year after an elm dies and maybe the second year, and then they kind of disappear. So they seem to have some kind of a symbiotic relationship with elms, and also old orchards, old apple orchards, apparently are hospitable to them. So, you know, that's one of the great mysteries. Everybody wants to grow morels, but it's a tough one. So if you figure that out, you can make millions.
I've got a couple of spots that I'll be visiting in the very near future, as a matter of fact, and I'm not telling where they are.
And you're not taking your cell phone so that nobody can track you, right?
Exactly. Oh, man. Well, it's good to talk morel mushrooms, and it's good to talk perennial edibles and all kinds of things that we're visiting with our two guests about, Diana Alfeth, UW Extension horticulture educator for Pierce County, and Kevin Chesso. He also works out of Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties, and is the ag development educator for UW Extension. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guests Diana Alfeth and Kevin Chesso. Diana works out of the Pierce County area. She's a UW Extension horticulture educator. She also teaches landscape design. Kevin is the ag development educator for UW Madison's Division of Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties. So our lines are all filled, so we'll go right back to the phones and to Stella in Sturgeon Bay. Hello, Stella.
Hi. Excuse me. Hi. I was calling with a couple things. The first one is the woman from Appleton who called in asking about pear growing pear variety.
Yeah.
We used to get, we live in Door County, and before we lived here but came here frequently, we used to get a pear. It's called Flemish Beauty. I believe it probably would be considered an heirloom variety. We used to get them at the Lautenbach Orchard just south of Fish Creek on Highway 42. They are small. They are incredibly sweet. They're just the most delicious pear we've ever had. And we used to make pear applesauce with them, combining them with Cortland apples. And it's it was just amazing. But they don't keep well, and so they're not a good commercial pear. And he stopped growing them. We haven't been able to find them anywhere else. But a Flemish Beauty, if she can find that for a home pear tree, would be just wonderful. And the second thing that I wanted to mention, when you were talking, somebody asked about getting disease on tomatoes. Not all of our tomato crop, but a large portion of our tomato crop, we grow under a hoop house, a plastic, looks like an old Quonset hut.
Yeah.
And we use a drip irrigation system on the soil, and so we never water from the air, and they never get rain on them, and the soil never gets rain on it. So there's never any splashing up from the soil, and we don't have any problems with disease.
Oh.
Yeah, I can just briefly, I guess, compliment you on, the comments about the hoop house. At the research station here in Spooner, we've been participating with Dr. Julie Dawson from UW-Madison Horticulture on a seed-to-kitchen collaborative. It's a vegetable variety trial. And one of the things that she's been doing is trialing different vegetable varieties, suitable for fresh market, of course. But she's got the same tomato varieties growing in high tunnel, growing in a portable high tunnel that is called a caterpillar tunnel. Those are tunnels that you can take up and down every year, so they're not as permanent as the high tunnels. And then, of course, we have trellised outside in the ground with no covering. And it's amazing when you walk through those structures in the middle of the summer, especially as you get towards the end of the season, the outside tomatoes always have more disease than those that are grown under the plastic and in that controlled environment. And I think some of that has to get back to the fact that, like Diana said earlier, some of these spores will blow into our gardens from adjacent areas. And with that covering, the spores are protected, the plants are protected. So we've seen substantial differences in the hoop house tunnels versus outside. So, again, environment does make a difference.
And thanks again for that question and comment. Appreciate it very much. Marla in Cottage Grove, your turn now. Hi, Marla.
Good morning. Thank you. In 2016, we planted some Victoria rhubarb, and last year and now again this year, it seems to be bolting early, and the stalks are kind of limp or weak or almost hollow, and I'm wondering why it's doing that.
Hmm. Wow. Either of you have a comment on that? I'm not sure.
Well, I'm just wondering, rhubarb likes really rich soil, at least the rhubarb that I've always grown and seen thrive has done best where there's, lots of organic matter and, of course, adequate moisture. But I'm just curious, is your soil, what kind of soil type are you trying to grow your rhubarb in?
Oh, we may have lost Marla there. I think we lost her.
Yeah, I just know from, growing rhubarb in different places and talking to people who've tried to grow rhubarb, if you're in really sandy, droughty, dry soil conditions, rhubarb doesn't thrive. And maybe it's the acidity, the lack of moisture, the lack of nutrients. It just doesn't seem to do as well in those kind of soil conditions. So that would be a question that I would have is, what are those general soil conditions that rhubarb was established in? Because if it was planted in 2016, I believe she said, you know, it should have several years to get established. And if it's going to be happy, you should start seeing, you know, some regular, you know, normal kind of production and thriving. So I'm curious if it isn't maybe a soil issue. And if you do have sandy soils, we got to be adding all kinds of composted manures or leaf mold or other, organic sources to the base of that plant and just enriching that soil as much as we can. Because I think, you know, again, my experience with rhubarb is it does like those richer soils.
And I should mention, too, that Victoria is considered one of the heirloom varieties, and heirloom varieties tend to flower more often than the more modern cultivars that have been kind of selected and bred to not bolt. So Victoria is probably not the best one from that standpoint. But like Kevin mentioned, any kind of stress to rhubarb will usually cause it to flower or bolt, and that stress can be from lack of water. So like Kevin mentioned, if it's on sandy soil with not good organic matter, not good rich soil, or any kind of pest problem or lack of nutrients, those kinds of stresses can kind of make that plant feel threatened, and it'll start flowering to set seed to kind of save its life, sort of a thing. So Victoria's one that's going to want to flower faster in the first place, and then any kind of stress is going to trigger it even more.
So there you go. Thank you so much for that call. Lee in Grand Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Lee.
I would like your guest's comment on the use of, we can use the term row cover. I've seen some of the garden centers call it frost guard, you know, the cloth, like a cheesecloth, for protection of frost for annuals mostly, and how much degrees wise will they give that protection?
Okay.
You know, row covers are one of my favorite things in the world that not enough people use. I always tell people to put it on their holiday wish list so people buy it for them for the year, because row covers can do a lot of things. They keep insects off of plants. They come in different weights, and the amount of light that gets through them is perfectly fine. Water can get through them. And there are some that are thicker and are called, as the caller says, frost covers. They give you a few degrees of temperature difference. So so they'll act just like any bed sheet or anything else that you might be covering to keep frost off, because frost comes from above and it settles on the plant. So anything you can do to keep frost from settling on those leaves protects you from frost. When we're talking about freeze like we are now, it'll give you maybe 3, maybe 4 degrees temperature difference. Now, the best thing to do it, and I know our state fruit specialist was talking about this in the form of apples too, is right now today, at least here in western Wisconsin, it's sunny. So that sun is hitting the soil. So if you allow that sun to warm the soil and raise the soil temperature a couple of degrees during the day, and then as that sun's getting low, put your frost cover on or your sheets, that sort of thing, that will help to trap some of that warmth down in that soil, and it'll radiate out over the night under that covering and give you a few degrees of temperature. So the row covers are very thin. The ones that are marketed as frost covers are a little bit thicker, and so they give you a little bit more cold protection.
And they don't cost very much either. I mean, when you think about it, it's fairly cheap.
It is, and you can reuse them. It's not like, you know, it's a one-time thing. You can use them for a couple of years. They will break down and start tearing or something, depending on how you handle them, how much you use them, and how much you let them get wet and muddy. but they are a great investment, and like I said, a lot of people don't grow broccoli in the garden because of the little green caterpillars that get on them, and those are the larvae of the little sulfur butterflies, the little white and yellow butterflies.
butterflies that float around. But we don't need pollinators to get to broccoli because we eat it before it flowers and we're not looking for pollination. So if you plant broccoli and you put those row covers over it, then the butterflies can't access it to lay their eggs, so you never get those nasty little green caterpillars on your plate. And so row covers are really, really good things for many different purposes, especially just creating a physical barrier for insects to not be able to access your plants. But again, in this case, there are the thicker ones that are specifically called frost covers, and you can use them, you know, multiple years. So good investment.
And just lay them right over the top.
You lay them over the top, anchor them down the corners so that you're sure that the wind doesn't take them, that sort of a thing. If you're growing under them all year as a row cover, you want to make sure that's well anchored so that it, you know, a thunderstorm doesn't come and blow it all off and stuff. But if you're using it for frost protection, you can do a more temporary anchoring.
All right. Diana Althoff, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County. Kevin Chesso is the Ag Development Educator for UW-Madison's Division of Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties. Always great to have them with us. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you with us today, and also great to have our two guests, Diana Althoff and Kevin Chesso, back with us. Diana, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County, and Kevin is the Ag Development Educator for UW-Madison's Division of Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties. So, what gardening questions do you have? Give a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. We would love to hear from you. And we'll go right back to the phone. Charlotte in McConnell, Illinois, has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Charlotte.
Hello there. I need the names of two varieties of disease-free apple trees for zones 3 or 4 that would bloom at the same time and cross-pollinate.
Zone 3 and 4.
Kevin, that's your territory.
I'm going to go back to our Wisconsin fruit website and use that as a jumping-off place for people to get questions like this answered. We have a number of different publications on that website. I'm just glancing at it right now. And the varieties, there's apple cultivars for Wisconsin under the varieties tab. So, again, I don't have a lot of this stuff at the top of my head. But there is a table that lists any number of varieties. And whenever we look at selecting varieties, and Charlotte, I don't know if you have any specific requirements, but when apples mature is certainly something we need to keep in mind, because if they're going to have ripe fruit that goes deep into the fall, we won't get to enjoy them because, you know, they won't be ready and we'll get too cold a temperature. So we have to first look at when that maturity level is. So we have early maturing varieties and, of course, later maturing varieties that do well. And as far as the disease resistance, there are a number of them to consider. The ones that I'm reading here on this website would be apples like Red Free and Prima, Priscilla, Jonifree, Liberty. So those are all types of disease-resistant apples that are listed here. And I think there's some good selections and as far as when they ripen. And if they ripen early, I'm assuming they're going to flower at about the same time. So you got to pick varieties that will have similar maturities, I guess is what I'm saying, because I'm assuming that they're going to flower at about the same time in the spring.
Yeah.
And you're correct that apples do need to be cross-pollinated. You can't just have one apple tree, especially if there's not another crab apple or wild apple in the vicinity, because you need to bring pollen from another variety to that flower to cross-pollinate it. So that's one of the unique things about apples is they do require cross-pollination. So I don't know if any of those varieties were ones you heard of, but if you go to that website, perhaps you can, you know, do a little research and find varieties that sound interesting for you and your location.
And if you go to WPR.org/Larry and then look in the program notes over on the right, and we've got the site there that Kevin was talking about listed, and you can find it right there, Charlotte. So it's WPR.org/Larry. And then over on the right-hand side of the page, you'll see program notes, and the information will be there. So good luck, and thank you so much for calling. Charlie in Beaver Dam has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Charlie.
Plants, two are doing real well, and one's not doing well at all. I was just wondering what kind of organic fertilizer I can use, a horse manure or a cow manure, and when should I use it?
Okay, so organic fertilizer for rhubarb plants. Horse manure, cow manure.
Yeah, Diana, you know, I know you've got horses. You might have a thing to say about using that. But
I have a huge supply.
Composted.
You know, the thing is that it doesn't really matter what animal came out of. What you're mainly adding is organic matter plus all the trace nutrients. Compost, as long as it's composted, that's what you want. So you don't want to be bringing along weed seeds, and composting process will kill off pathogens and weed seeds. So you want to make sure it's not recognizable anymore. But any manure is going to be similar. Now, the amount of nitrogen in the compost or in any kind of manure will vary slightly, and that just depends on the species, what the animal ate, that sort of a thing. But generally speaking, compost is low in nitrogen. Manure, once it's been composted, is relatively low nitrogen, but it has all those other trace minerals and phosphorus and potassium in it. And again, what you're really adding is organic matter that helps with all the microbes that are in the soil that release the nutrients to the plant, and on and on and on. So whether it's cattle manure or horse manure isn't that important, as long as it's well composted.
All right, Charlie, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Raxram in Brookfield, I believe you're up next. Hi.
Hi. Hey, Larry. I grow some vegetable garden. And
Oh, I think we lost him. You cut out there. Here, his cucumber plants are dying every year.
Okay, so do they, like, just kind of started and then die off, or is it once they're kind of out there and growing and close to producing and then they die off?
They start growing really good when they start flowering, and the crops keep on coming, then they start dying all of a sudden.
Okay. Do the leaves happen to turn white?
Yes.
They do?
Yes.
Okay. So you're probably getting powdery mildew on there, which is a fungal disease, a foliar fungal disease, comes in the wind. It's usually worst when we get the warm, humid conditions, and so that's usually midsummer, right, when those cucumbers are going. And if you get it bad enough, it can actually kill those plants off. So I'm going to guess that you have a powdery mildew issue. And if you've had it in the past and you've had it a lot, look for cucumber varieties that have some resistance to it. And otherwise, you can do some treatments. There's just like a baking soda mix that are
disease diagnostician recommends sometimes. But again, they need to be applied before the leaves start turning white and the powdery mildew gets going. But cucumbers can be really susceptible to that. So that's my first guess at what's happening.
And there was a lot of powdery mildew around the last couple of years.
Yeah, and again, it likes warm, humid conditions, and with all the rain that we've had the last couple of years, there's been a lot of soil moisture giving off humidity, and so there's been a lot of humid conditions right near those plants.
Yeah, there you go.
Thank you so much. I guess this just brings up, you know, some of those general rules of thumb that we always talk about in gardening, and I know, Larry, you've heard me talk about this before, but we have to do some horticulture CSI, right? We have to do our crime scene investigation, do our scouting. You know, we can't just plant our plants and walk away. I mean, so we should be watching and looking and observing. And sometimes we can see symptoms and signs showing up. And if we catch it early, we might be able to deal with it. But we can also maybe diagnose it and learn from what is happening. And you might lose the crop this year, but we can always learn from our experiences and, you know, taking pictures and going online or sharing those pictures with, you know, a local extension office or any number of other places we can use to help get the diagnosis done. Because some of these are easy to diagnose and some of them are a little more challenging, but, you know, that's where that putting that CSI hat on and trying to figure out what's going on. And it's not easy. You know, powdery mildew is a very common one on cucumbers, but there's other fungal and sometimes bacterial diseases that can cause problems, and we just don't know. So that's why we have our eyes open and look and scout and use all those skills we have and learn. And over the phone, it's really difficult to know exactly what's going on, you know, without all those pictures and other, you know, diagnostics.
Yeah.
But just encouraging people to learn as they go along.
And another part of that is most of our diseases in vegetable gardens and fruits as well, but especially in vegetable gardens, are fungal. There are a few bacterial diseases, but most of them are related to some kind of fungus. And everybody just needs to remember fungus likes high humidity or wet leaves. So the more we can keep leaves dry, the more we can create a good air circulation to keep the humidity lower. All of those things will help to reduce, if not eliminate, some of these fungal pressures. So like Kevin said, CSI really comes into play here. It's hard to do plant autopsies sometimes, but the more we can set things up for good growing conditions, the less diseases there will be.
And thanks again for that call. Krista in Appleton emailed, she's interested in growing blueberry bushes, possibly in raised beds. Any ideas on how to do this well? If she puts them in the ground, she has clay soil, which probably isn't the best, and certainly it is not the best for blueberries.
Yeah, blueberries are one of those kind of unique crops, and I think most people should be aware, but if not, you know, they have a very specific pH requirement. They love acid soils, and one of the reasons for that is they have a high demand for iron, and when our pH is low, we have more iron available to the plant. Plus, they have very unique root systems that don't have a lot of root hairs, so they just have this need for low acid or low pHs, and you know, they don't like wet feet. And so sometimes when we move them into containers, we can make adjustments for that. But anytime we put plants in the containers, we have to really think about, you know, that rooting environment and moisture and how do we keep them watered. So I would start with, you know, having a soil test done, making sure you understand where your soil pH is.
I think she wanted to go to a raised bed situation where she could be adding in.
Yep. Raised beds are wonderful, and a lot of times blueberries are grown, especially commercially, in somewhat of a raised bed fashion where they'll try to bring that root zone above the normal soil profile, and they'll have it mulched really well with, organic materials. And, drip irrigation and all those things that commercial growers do. But that would be one of the things I'd definitely take a look at is, you know, what kind of site conditions you have. And then, you know, there's any number of varieties that will work. There's low bush to medium to even higher bush, meaning 3-4 foot tall plants. So it's just something to keep in mind. And again, I don't want to keep talking about this website, but the Wisconsin fruit website will have links to growing blueberries. Minnesota and Wisconsin both have really good websites that talk about blueberry production. So I would check that out online if you're able to.
Yeah, that's very good advice. Again, you can just go to WPR.org/Larry and look over in the program notes and you'll see that website or those websites. So, Barb in Milwaukee, what's on your mind?
Good morning. I have a Montmorency cherry tree. We've had it about 20 years. The last couple of years, it has not been fruiting much. This year, it hardly has any flowers. I'm wondering, is there a life, you know, problem here? Is it because it's too old? Is there a better tree for southeastern Wisconsin for sour cherries?
Can I ask if there's any damage on the trunk, any, like, hole in the bark or any area where sap is oozing out or anything like that?
I have not noticed that, no. But a lot of the thinner branches are dead.
Yeah. So usually when we get dieback on a tree, there's some kind of a break or a block between the roots and the top of the tree. So then water can't get up there and nutrients and that sort of thing. So the tree will start dying back. And Montmorency cherries and any cherries, any of our fruits that have a pit in the middle are really susceptible to some bacterial canker diseases, and they can get on the branches or the trunk, and they just kind of start growing in there, and then that causes that break in the connection from the roots to the top of the tree. So my first thing would be to really look at the trunk all the way from the base to the top. If there's any kind of wound on that trunk from past deer rubbing or rabbit damage or anything that might be blocking that connection, that might be what's happening. So the Montmorency is not going to necessarily have a lifespan only 20 years old, although, you know, they do get older eventually. But chances are there's something there. It could even be bad branch structure where if multiple branches are coming out from one place or they're crossing branches and they're kind of growing into each other, they might be strangling each other, and then one of them is dying off. So those would be the first things that I would look for. If there is a canker disease in there on the trunk where, like, sap is oozing or something like that, there's really nothing you can do about it. If it was on a branch, we could prune it out. If it's in the trunk, we obviously can't prune it out. And then your tree's probably going to just continue to decline.
Oh. There you go, Barb. Thank you so much for calling. Let's turn to Jill in Racine. Jill, hello. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. At first, I was going to put a service berry by bird feeders. And then when I looked at them, they're pretty tall, and the lower branches get bare. And now I'm thinking maybe not something that's deciduous, but maybe a low evergreen to put by the bird. I know the service berries had berries for the birds, but they seem
You're
to
looking
like
for evergreen. Protection? Are you looking for protection, Jill, for the birds?
No, just for something to sit in.
Okay. All right. So what have you got for a recommendation? Let's see. Let's go to Diana first. Diana?
So service berries come in different heights. There's a shorter variety called Regent that only gets like 6-7 feet tall. And then there's the more native, I think there's one called Autumn Blazer, Autumn Brilliance, something like that, that'll get 14 to 15 feet tall. And even though as it grows up, normally they have multiple trunks.
You can prune it to be one trunk if you like it that way, but normally they have multiple trunks, and even though as it grows up, those lower branches will become a little bare, you are absolutely right on. Provide some kind of a place for those birds to perch near the feeder, because birds don't like to be out in the open. Little birds don't like to be out in the open because big birds can come and eat them. So so they like being able to fly into the tree, have some shelter from any hawks or things that are flying above looking for them, and then they fly out to the feeder, grab some food, fly back into the tree. I actually think a service berry would be a great choice for that because there are multiple branches and stems and things in there. They will flower. They'll get the fruit on them. I'll also tell you that usually it's cedar wax rings that come through for a service berry, and as soon as those berries start getting ripe, they will come in and gobble down each and every one of them within 2 days, and they're gone. So it's not a long-term thing that it's providing food, but service berries are great plants. They're beautiful spring flowers. They're a native. So I think it would be a good choice, and actually in some ways better than an evergreen, just because evergreens can be kind of thick and there's not a lot of perching spots inside those evergreens for these little birds to go in and out of.
I think that's good advice. Thank you very much, Jill, for calling. Appreciate it. Sue wondered from Neshota what she can grow, what shrubs she can grow under black walnut trees. Yeah.
Kevin, I don't know if you have any suggestions, but I know we have a publication that Laura Jell, our woody plant specialist, has, and it should be on our Learning Store website, and it's called Juglone Tolerant Plants. And juglone is the compound in black walnuts that kind of tries
everything
to knock out the competition.
Yeah, juglone, and we have that website as well up on our on my page, so you can go to the wpr.org/Larry and then look at program notes, and we've got that horticulture website up on our site, and you can just go there and click, and you can find plants, and there aren't a ton of them, but there are some that will work under black walnuts.
And I should mention, I've talked with Laura Jell about this and creating that list. If you search like University of Minnesota or some of the other upper Midwest universities, a lot of them have lists, but just to for everyone to beware, those lists are usually based on anecdotal observations,
yeah,
because it's really hard to do any kind of a controlled research study for them because you'd have to, you know, grow things out for 20 years and all that. But it's a good starting spot.
Well,
yeah,
Diana,
I actually was able to, you know, while you were talking, Diana, pull up a reference here. And again, you know, we have all these terms we use, and we say sensitive or tolerant. And they're somewhat subjective in that regard, but there are a number of them that are listed on there that
as well.
Okay.
Yeah. Kevin Chesso, thank you. Diana Alpha, thank you as well. Diana is a UW Extension horticulture educator for Pierce County. Kevin's the ag development educator for Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties. And we'll have them back, and we will talk with them again. We're out of time, though, so I just to let you know, on Monday, Jesse LeGrew back to talk about how to get your home Wi-Fi to work better. That's on Monday. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mehler.